York, this is Democracy Now! A federal jury in Virginia has ordered a group of white supremacists to pay over $26 million in damages for their role in organizing the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. We'll get the latest and look at the trial in Georgia of the three white men who killed Ahmaud Arbery. Then to a disturbing story about rape near Buffalo, New York. A judge has sparked outrage after ruling it's inappropriate to jail a young serial rapist from a prominent family who pleaded guilty to raping and sexual assaulting four teenage girls aged 15 and 16. We'll speak to one survivor who was in the courtroom during the sentencing.
I lost it. I mean, I didn't expect to be as emotional as I was, but I just broke down. I was shaking with anger. I was disgusted at the fact that this was even an option.
Then to the war party. We speak to award-winning investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill about how U.S. militarism is the great unifier from Bush to Obama and Trump to Biden.
All discussions about China, all discussions about Russia regarding U.S. policy leave out the role that the United States plays in destabilizing the world, but also provoking responses from other nations.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A jury in Charlottesville, Virginia, found the organizers of the deadly 2017 Unite the Right rally liable for the event's violence, awarding nine plaintiffs $26 million in damages. Convicted murderer James Fields, who is already serving multiple life sentences for killing activist Heather Heyer when he rammed his car into a crowd of counter-protesters, was found liable for $12 million in punitive damages. The 12 defendants included three other high-profile white supremacist figures, former leader of the alt-right movement Richard Spencer, event organizer Jason Kessler, and neo-Nazi podcast host Christopher Cantwell. Defendants have been ordered to pay plaintiffs $500,000 each, and five white nationalists groups were ordered to pay $1 million each. The jury, however, was deadlocked on two federal conspiracy charges. The House panel investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection issued subpoenas Tuesday to far-right groups, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. Both groups are believed to be involved in planning and taking part in the deadly attack. Dozens of people affiliated with the white supremacist organizations have been indicted by the Justice Department and a federal grand jury. In Georgia, jury deliberations continue today in the trial of three white men who chased down and killed 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery, a black man who was out for a jog. The prosecution offered its closing arguments on Tuesday ahead of jury deliberation.
They started it. They do not get to claim self-defense. And then, of course, provocation. You can't force someone to defend themselves against you, so you get to claim self-defense. This isn't the Wild West.
Outside the courthouse, Ahmaud Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, struck a hopeful note.
I do think that we will come back with a guilty verdict. And I want to leave you with this. God has brought us this far, and he's not going to fail us now.
Amen.
We will get justice for Ahmaud.
We'll have more on both this case and the Unite the Right verdict after headlines with journalist Nicole Lewis. In Missouri, Kevin Strickland, an African-American man who was wrongfully convicted of a triple murder in 1979 by an all-white jury, has been exonerated and released from prison after over 43 years. Strickland was arrested when he was 18, had maintained his innocence ever since. He's now 62. His case is the longest confirmed wrongful incarceration in Missouri's history. In international news, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has gone to the front lines of battle, according to Ethiopian state media. Government operations have been handed over to the deputy prime minister. Abiy challenged Tigrayan forces to meet him on the battlefield as they threaten to march on the capital, Addis Ababa. The year-long conflict has claimed thousands of lives and has led to widespread violations of human rights from all involved parties, according to the UN, some of which could amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. Chun-Doo Hwan, the former U.S.-backed military dictator of South Korea, has died at the age of 90. General Chun seized power through a coup in 1979. A year later, he ordered a brutal attack on a pro-democracy uprising in Gwangju, with estimates of the death toll ranging from 500 to over 2,000 people. At the time, then U.S. President Jimmy Carter backed the violent crackdown on the pro-democracy protesters. Korean activists are demanding the U.S. acknowledge its role in Chun's rise to power and the cruelty of his regime. Portugal has shut down its last coal-fired power plant, making it the fourth European nation to give up coal. The move comes 9 years ahead of a 2030 target set by the Portuguese government. Climate activists hail the move, but warn the plant should not be converted to producing energy through fossil fuels, wood, or other non-sustainable materials. President Biden announced the U.S. will tap into its strategic oil reserves in hopes of reducing energy prices. The U.S. will release 50 million barrels of crude oil, Biden spoke Tuesday.
It will take time, but before long, you should see the price of gas drop where you fill up your tank. And in the longer term, we will reduce our reliance on oil as we shift to clean energy. But right now, I will do what needs to be done to reduce the price you pay at the pump.
Britain, China, India, Japan, and South Korea will also authorize the release of oil. Climate groups condemn the move, which comes less than 2 weeks after the UN climate summit in Glasgow. Apple has filed a lawsuit in U.S. federal court against the Israeli firm NSO Group, accusing the surveillance company of hacking Apple devices with its Pegasus spyware. In the suit, Apple denounces NSO as an amoral 21st-century mercenaries who've used their technology to enable human rights abuses. The lawsuit is the second of its kind. Facebook sued NSO for targeting its WhatsApp users in 2019. The Pegasus spyware has been used by governments to target hundreds of activists, journalists, and government officials. In Ohio, a federal jury found the drugstore chains CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart helped fuel the opioid crisis in two Ohio counties. Lawyers for the plaintiffs successfully used the state's public nuisance laws to deliver the first verdict holding major drug retailers liable for the opioid epidemic. The families of the victims and survivors of the 2018 mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, have reached a nearly $130 million settlement with the Justice Department. The families had sued the FBI, accusing the agency of negligence for failing to act on tips they received about the gunman just weeks before the massacre. At the time, the tipster told the FBI the shooter was, quote, going to explode, and that he, quote, was going to slip into a school and start shooting the place up, unquote. 17 student, staff, and teachers were killed that day. Here in New York, the city council is pushing forward a bill that would allow New York residents who are not U.S. citizens to register as members of political parties and vote in municipal elections. The move would open up voting to over 800,000 New Yorkers who have green cards or other work authorization. This is Murad Awada of the New York Immigration Coalition.
We're on the cusp of making history together by expanding our democracy just when voting rights are under attack across the nation.
The legislation is expected to be approved in December by a veto-proof majority. In Brooklyn, New York, Malika Shabazz, one of Malcolm X's six daughters, was found dead in her home on Monday at the age of 56. Police said they believe her death was of natural causes. Malika and her twin sister, Malak, were the youngest daughters of the civil rights icon and were born after their father was assassinated on February 21, 1965. In Tucson, Arizona, supporters of Hiached and Tohono O'odham land and water protector Amber Ortega held a solidarity rally on Tuesday as Ortega awaits a trial verdict over federal misdemeanor charges for peacefully protesting the construction of the U.S.-Mexico border wall near Quito-Baquito Springs. The site is sacred to O'odham people. Ortega was arrested in September of 2020 alongside O'odham land and water protector Nellie Jo David after blocking construction machinery. This is Ortega speaking to supporters outside the Tucson courthouse yesterday.
Our rights as a people need to be restored. Our lands need to be restored to the people, the natural caretakers, our creator. As children, we're raised to know where we come from, where our people come from, what mountains provided for us, what mountains we sing to, what landscapes, what waters took care of us. And we carry those stories because that's our history.
If convicted, Ortega faces up to 6 months in prison. To see our interview with Nellie Jo David last year, go to democracynow.org. And Wet'suwet'en land defender Slato, also known as Molly Wickham, was released from jail Tuesday evening after being arrested Friday during a violent raid by Canadian federal police on one of the camps set up to keep Coastal GasLink out of sovereign Indigenous territory. The raid ended a 56-day blockade of the drilling site in Canada. The 400-mile pipeline within Wet'suwet'en land violates both Indigenous and Canadian laws. 15 people in total were arrested Friday, including two journalists. One of them was documentary filmmaker Michael Toledano, who just released this dramatic footage of the raid.
They're walking to the door. They're breaking it down.
Breaking down the door.
Get out here.
They're breaking down the door.
Hey, show me hands.
Get that. Me. Get your gun off me. Lower your gun. Get your gun off me. This is sovereign Wet'suwet'en land.
The RCMP have breached the door. They are acting under the authority of the injunction.
The attack dogs are there.
There are attack dogs here.
Standing there.
Militarized
right beside the door.
Police. They used axes found in camp to break down the door.
And a chainsaw.
And a chainsaw that they found in camp.
Can we roll you under arrest?
Don't touch me.
Don't touch her.
Touch me. Get your hands off of her.
You're under arrest.
Get your hands off of her.
You're under arrest.
And filming a documentary for CBC television.
No problem. You're under arrest. Get that out of my face and back up. You're under arrest.
For the record, I'm a member of the media. You've been notified that I'm here. I'm observing.
You're under arrest right now. Step out.
Okay. I'm coming with you. I'm coming with you.
Camera down.
You're under arrest.
You don't want to break. Okay.
I'm a member of the media. I'm filming a documentary for CBC television. You are twisting my wrist. I'm a member of the media. I'm filming a documentary for CBC television. I have press credentials.
Footage of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police raiding Camp Coyote on Friday, filmed by documentary filmmaker Michael Toledano, who was arrested during the raid, then jailed for 3 days. Visit democracynow.org to see our recent interview with the Wet'suwet'en land defender, Slato. She spoke to us on Friday, shortly before the raid. The cabin she was speaking to us from has since been burned to the ground. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, a federal jury in Virginia has ordered a group of white supremacists to pay over $26 million in damages for their role in organizing the deadly 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. The jury found the organizers guilty of violating a Virginia state conspiracy law, but jurors deadlocked on two federal conspiracy charges, including violating the 1871 Ku Klux Klan Act. In August 2017, several hundred white supremacists marched with tiki torches across the University of Virginia, chanting, "You will not replace us, Jews will not replace us, and white lives matter." The next day, self-described neo-Nazi James Alex Fields slammed his car into a crowd of anti-racist counter-protesters, killing Heather Heyer and injuring dozens of others. On Tuesday, Fields, who's already serving a life sentence, was ordered to pay $12 million in punitive damages. Prominent white supremacists Richard Spencer, Jason Kessler, and Christopher Cantwell, and eight other defendants were also ordered to each pay over $500,000 in punitive damages. While it's unclear how much money the men will actually pay, many observers are crediting the civil lawsuit with helping to bankrupt numerous far-right institutions. We're joined now by Nicole Lewis, senior editor of jurisprudence at Slate. Nicole, welcome to Democracy Now! In a moment, we're also going to go to Georgia with you to talk about the Ahmaud Arbery murder trial. But right now, talk about the significance of this civil suit, of this the jury finding these men guilty, and what $26 million means.
Sure. So the lawyers for the plaintiff said that this judgment, this amount of money, really sends a message to other people who might think that they want to show up and commit violent acts in cities, that they can't get away with it, that there won't be, that they won't get off scot-free, that there will be some repercussions. And so $26 million, it's a lot of money, but there's a big question about, will these defendants be able to pay it? You know, Chris Cantwell, James Fields are already incarcerated, and so they are not earning a ton of money. Many of the other defendants are already destitute from all of the pre-investigation leading into this trial, the fact that they are not able to work, that they're now publicly known as white supremacists and neo-Nazis who are, you know, unemployable in a lot of industries and institutions, right? And so I think there is just this big outstanding question of how much money will they actually be able to come up with and what strategies do they have to be able to extract money from these folks, you know, liens on houses, garnishing wages, things like that. But I think the bigger picture here is that, you know, they came into Charlottesville with the intention to create and start a race war, and that the criminal justice system hasn't found any liability. But in a civil system, we say, you know, you cannot get away with this.
And in terms of the organizations that these men belong to, many of them are either going to declare bankruptcy and then reorganize under other names, or what's your sense of what's happened to the organizations?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. And I think it's the question that we're all, you know, grappling with or dealing with to say, is bankrupting these organizations, is bankrupting these individuals enough to actually stop the growing threat of the rising threat of white supremacy and Nazism in the United States? We know that there are a number of young men who feel disaffected and displaced, and they're gathering every day in chat rooms to share ideas, to commiserate, to strategize. And so there's a high likelihood that the organizations that exist now become defunct, they turn over whatever assets they might have on hand, and then new organizations are started. And you know, new people come together in chat rooms to plan for this kind of thing. And so I think it's just the open question of we don't yet know. And I think it's important to point out that this was the strategy used to try to take down the Ku Klux Klan, you know, in the Jim Crow era and through the civil rights movement, right? And so there was some effectiveness there. But again, looking back in time and sort of moving forward, we see that one hateful group, one white supremacist group, just morphed into new factions and new iterations of the same ideology. And so is bankrupting them actually truly enough to stamp out hate? I don't think so. I think there are many people who study hate and extremism who know just how extraordinary the threat is, and that financial damages just simply won't be enough to do that.
In October, you co-wrote a piece with Dahlia Lithwick titled Three Trials in America, the conversation playing out in courtrooms in Kenosha, Charlottesville, and Georgia are revealing. What do you find revealing about and the connections between all three of these?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, every few years we get a series of cases that that people look to say, will the ruling, will the outcome here finally be an indication that we have made progress in terms of race and racial relations and racial justice? And so the case in Kenosha, the case in Georgia, the Charlottesville case, I really don't think you could get three sort of bigger, more significant cases. One, you know, Charlottesville, about the rise of extremism, Nazism, our First Amendment rights, like what right do you have actually to create violence in public spaces, you know, the trial in Kenosha about whether or not we have, you know, whether or not the Second Amendment, our gun rights, are sort of more important than our ability to peacefully assemble, right? And then we have the case in Georgia that really reflects this long legacy of racial violence in the South. The three defendants are white. Ahmaud Arbery, the young unarmed jogger, was black, right? And so they just encapsulate all these different components, all these different issues happening in our country right now. And what Dahlia and I were trying to point out is that the criminal justice system even the civil system, right? The Charlottesville case is not a criminal case. It's simply just ill-equipped to deal with these extraordinary questions of race. It is the same system that disproportionately sends Black and Latino men to prison at extraordinary rates. And so when we bring white defendants into the system and ask it to litigate and to say, let's find justice here, many of us watching know that it won't be able to do that. And I think the Rittenhouse trial for many, the Rittenhouse verdict, excuse me, for many was devastating for that reason. People did not expect that he would be treated the way that he was, that he would be acquitted, right? And so there's another component here. When Dahlia and I watched the jury selection and many of these cases, we could not help but notice just how much the defense attorneys in particular, treated racism like an open question. And so any juror who believed that racism is real, that Black Lives Matter is not a terrorist organization, that in fact it emerged, you know, in response to state-sanctioned violence against Black people, anyone who believed those things to be true was struck from the jury, that it was read as somehow not being neutral and not being objective, of not having an open mind, when we know that these are settled and established facts. And so I think we just saw the extraordinary limitation here to say, well, what can we do if the jury pool is now comprised of people whose minds are not made up about Nazism, whose minds are not made up about the horrors, the violence, and the evil of white supremacy? And so that's just another extraordinary limitation and something that we saw a thread throughout all three trials.
So I want to go to that trial in Georgia right now, which is now in jury deliberations. Again, of course, this is a trial of the three white men, a father and son, the father a former police officer, and their neighbor, who hunted down and killed 25-year-old Black jogger Ahmaud Arbery. You recently wrote a piece titled, Why Are Ahmaud Arbery's Killers So Scared? Now, I first want to go to the prosecutor, Linda Dunikofsky, during the trial, questioning Travis McMichael.
At this point in time, when you first see him on Burford, he's not reaching into his pockets.
No, ma'am.
And he never yelled at you guys?
No, ma'am.
Never threatened you at all?
No, ma'am.
Never brandished any weapons?
Sorry, Your Honor, he's trying to finish his answer.
Yeah, he did not threaten me verbally. No, ma'am.
All right. Didn't brandish any weapons?
No, ma'am.
Didn't pull out any guns?
No, ma'am.
Didn't pull out any knife?
No, ma'am.
Never reached for anything, did he?
No.
He just ran?
Yes, he was just running.
Clearly a key moment in this trial. Well, on Tuesday, prosecutor Linda Dunikofsky delivered her closing argument.
They started it. They do not get to claim self-defense. And then, of course, provocation. You can't force someone to defend themselves against you, so you get to claim self-defense. This isn't the Wild West.
That, again, the prosecutor delivering her final closing arguments, and now the jury is deliberating today for the second day. Nicole Lewis, again, this piece that you wrote, Why Are Ahmaud Arbery's Killers So Scared? Why do you think they are?
Yeah, I mean, so my central thesis for this piece is that fear, on the one hand, is often a just very convenient defense, you know, argument to claim self-defense. I was scared. I was scared for my life, and so I had to take action. But at the same time, it is also very clearly a racist dog whistle. And so what I mean by that is it sends a message to anyone watching, to white America, to say, you understand why I was so scared interacting with this young Black man. And I quoted Travis McMichael to say that, you know, Ahmaud Arbery was overpowering me, and it was so clear that if I didn't act, if he got my gun, that he would kill me. And we have no way of assessing Ahmaud Arbery's intentions, no way of knowing if he would have taken that gun and shot Travis, or just taken it to say, don't shoot me, right? No way of intoning what would have happened there. And yet the McMichaels claimed that they were terrified, even though Ahmaud Arbery was outnumbered, even though he'd been running for miles before the altercation. And so I really wanted to shift the frame and get us to try to think about Ahmaud's fear, Right? He's being hunted, stalked by a truck full of two white men with guns, with Confederate license plates. He's not sure what's going to happen, right? It's a terrifying moment. It's a terrifying end to somebody's life. But the McMichaels are the only ones who get to claim that they're scared. And this is a defense that we see time and again from private citizens as well as police officers who have all stood trial for shooting unarmed Black people, that they were about to be overpowered, that they were scared, even though they provoked these incidents. And I think that that was what the prosecutor was trying to get at, that you don't get to create a situation in which someone has to defend themselves against you and then claim that you were terrified and had to act.
Well, Nicole Lewis, we're going to link to your piece. Nicole is senior editor of jurisprudence at Slate. Her latest piece, Why Are Ahmaud Arbery's Killers So Scared? When we come back, we look at a highly disturbing story about rapes near Buffalo, New York, where a judge has sparked outrage after ruling it's inappropriate to jail a young serial rapist from a prominent white wealthy family who pleaded guilty to raping and sexual assaulting four teenage girls age 15 and 16. We'll speak with one of the survivors who was in the courtroom during the sentencing. Stay with us. Hallucination, formerly known as A Tribe Called Red. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Before we continue, a warning to our audience. In our next segment, we discuss sexual violence, a highly disturbing case here in New York that's drawn international condemnation after a man who pleaded guilty to raping and sexual assaulting four teenage girls will avoid prison after he received an extraordinarily lenient sentence of probation. Chris Belter, who's now 20 years old, received 8 years probation and no jail time after he pleaded guilty to attempted first-degree sexual abuse, third-degree rape, and two counts of second-degree sexual abuse. The four teenagers who Belter sexually assaulted at his home were 15 and 16. Belter, who's white and from a prominent family who lives in a wealthy neighborhood near Niagara Falls. The sentence of probation came after Belter had been accused of more serious crimes than the four attacks, but agreed to plead guilty to lesser charges. And a previous judge gave him an interim sentence of 2 years probation, along with a chance to be sentenced as a youthful offender and avoid registering as a sex offender. But Belter violated the terms of that probation multiple times and was sentenced as an adult. This is Judge Matthew Murphy speaking before he delivered the sentence of probation to Chris Belter last week in Niagara County.
I agonized. I'm not ashamed to say that I actually prayed over what is the appropriate sentence in this case. Because there was great pain, there was great harm, there were multiple crimes committed in the case.
In response to the judge's sentencing of Belter to no jail time, to probation, one of the survivors who was in the courtroom told Buffalo News Station WKBW she had to immediately run to the bathroom to throw up.
I lost it. I mean, I didn't expect to be as emotional as I was, but I just broke down. I was shaking with anger. I was disgusted at the fact that this was even an option.
For more, we're joined by that brave young woman who you just heard and her lawyer, Stephen Cohen, with Hogan Willig Law Firm. Mara, we're just using her first name at her request to protect some of her privacy, testified in court about how Christopher Belter raped her when she was just 16. She's now speaking out about Judge Murphy's decision to sentence him to probation. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Mara, we want to begin with you, and I know this is difficult. You're remarkably brave to talk publicly. Talk about your reaction to the sentence of probation. How did you respond in the courtroom?
I was so disappointed to hear the word probation. I fully expected to go into that courtroom and watch him get taken out in cuffs to go to prison. I mean, I was so disappointed in Judge Murphy that he made that decision.
What did you do?
I started crying. It's just like the tears started pouring out and I was shaking. I was just so furious and disgusted. I couldn't even control my own emotions and I got sick to my stomach.
And Mara, Belter apologized to you and his three other victims in court, but you said that his response sounded robotic and like someone else had written it for him. Your thoughts again about his apology?
Absolutely. He didn't mean a word coming out of his mouth. He was doing what was in his best interest, and the judge completely fell for it.
I mean, to understand, you were 16 years old, this is a few years ago, and you'd gone to Christopher Belter's house because you were friends with his sister and you were sleeping over so that you could go with her to Chicago the next day?
Correct, yes.
You've compared what happened to you to the wildfires, the forest fires in California. Can you explain?
Yeah, before Christopher came into my life and before he did this to me and to these other girls, we were just a bunch of bright green trees, and he burned us down. He ruined us.
Did you know the other girls?
I did, yes. We all went to school together. We were all friends with his sister.
I'd like to bring in your lawyer, Steve Cohen, into the conversation. Mr. Cohen, your response to the judge's sentence, and also could you talk about how you said that the crimes Belter committed were far worse than what he pleaded to. How was this plea deal developed?
The plea deal was a shock when it was originally offered, and the district attorney at the time, Carolyn Wotasik, made promises to the girls that if they consent to this plea deal, that Chris Belter would be subject to restrictions that he would most certainly violate. And they agreed. The district attorney, Carolyn Wotasik, got these girls to agree to consent to the plea with the understanding that there's no way that Chris would be able to stay away from a cell phone and a computer and stay away from parties and keep himself confined to the house, and then he would go to prison for violation of the terms. Well, they agreed to it. He violated the terms of probation, and nothing happened. I was getting calls from the from my client and her parents and the other victims and their parents saying, hey, we just saw Chris Belter, you know, at this location doing this, that, or the other thing. He's in violation of probation. So I sent a letter back in August of 2020 to the probation officer and to the district attorney, Carolyn Wotasik, and I said, look, these are violations. He has just, I have screenshots of a drug transaction he just engaged in. You know, allegedly, that's what was provided to me. I'm providing it to you. Not a single call back. When the probation officer testified on his behalf at this sentencing here, it was the most among the most bizarre things I've seen in my 30 plus years of practicing law.
And Mr. Cohen, you said that if Belter was not a rich white kid from a privileged background and influential family, he'd be in prison right now. Could you talk about his family and even the role of his parents in some of these incidents?
Well, his parents are very very privileged. His father is a very successful attorney. His father doesn't live with Christopher. This is really on the mother, Tricia Vacanti, and the stepfather, Gary Sullo, and the neighbor, Jessica Long. Chris Belter Sr. doesn't live at the house that's come to be known as the Lewiston Party House. It's a mansion of impressive proportions. And I can tell you, having practiced for decades, an African-American, a Hispanic, a Native American, a Muslim defendant who was found guilty or pleaded guilty to these crimes would absolutely and appropriately be in prison. Chris Belter's mother is a lawyer, Trish Vacanti. Father is a lawyer. The stepfather is a businessman of, a very successful businessman. And I have to believe that that's what played a role in this. I mean, to get the probation officer to testify, to say, yeah, he violated probation, but we're not advocating for prison time, is shocking to me. You know, the therapist who was asked to evaluate Chris Belter, an expert, Dr. David Heffler, he's renowned as an expert in criminal sexual conduct and rehabilitation and recidivism. And he testified right in open court. He said, this man is likely to reoffend. And then he was asked, well, is it in Chris Belter's best interest to go to prison? And he honestly responded, in Chris Belter's best interest, no. No, Chris Belter, after 10 years of therapy and libido-reducing drugs, may be able to be cured. And the judge hung his hat on that. This shouldn't be about what's in Chris Belter's best interest. It should be about justice for the victims and, secondarily, protecting society from someone who the court's own expert, Dr. Heffler, said is likely to reoffend.
Now, to be clear, his mother and others have been charged, is that right, in aiding and abetting, giving some of the young people drugs, alcohol, and they've pleaded not guilty, but are they going to trial?
Well, they were charged with this 2 years ago, and so far nothing has happened. I've gone up to the Lewiston Town Court to watch the proceedings to see if anything would happen with these people, and it continues to get adjourned and adjourned and adjourned. So they seem to be evading the criminal justice system as well.
So, yeah. Go ahead, Juan.
I wanted to ask you, you're familiar with Judge Murphy. Could you talk about him and the interactions you've had with him or other lawyers have had with him in the past on cases?
I'll be perfectly honest with you. Judge Murphy has always been an excellent judge. I have been before His Honor in criminal cases, in civil cases, in pistol permit revocation cases, and he has always been a good judge to be in front of. He does the right thing, typically. I don't know what happened here. I can't figure it out.
The Buffalo News had a powerful editorial where they asked, does anyone remember any poor black defendants being treated so kindly for serial sexual abuse? And they went on to say, nor is this the first time Murphy, that's the judge, bent over backward for Belter. Earlier this year, in considering how to respond to a previous violation of his probation, Murphy prohibited the media from using Belter's name, even though it had already been reported and could easily be found on internet searches. What is with him and Belter? I mean, Belter is 20 years old.
I don't know. I can't figure it out. When the courtroom was an open courtroom, and when I went up to ask for the transcript, I originally was prohibited from getting the transcript. The judge eventually allowed me to get a transcript of the proceedings. I don't know. Something about this case has caused His Honor to act in a way that I've never known him to act before. He was a fine district attorney for years. Matthew Murphy was an excellent district attorney in Niagara County. This case is an aberration, and it is an outrage.
I wanted to go back to the Buffalo News and that editorial that they wrote condemning the judge's decision to not sentence this serial rapist to prison. They said Murphy isn't the first judge to value the prospects of promising young rapists over the suffering of their victims. Mara, you've said you believe your voice is powerful. How do you hope to inspire other young survivors? And have you and the other young women, again, who were raped and sexually abused at the age of 15 and 16, have you brought a civil lawsuit against Christopher Belter and his family?
We have. There's two of the victims who have, but not all four of us. And as for my voice, this was not just a disappointment to me. The outcome of this case was a disappointment to victims across the country. This is not just about the Belter case anymore. This is about all of the Christopher Belters in our country and all of the victims of them. And there needs to be a change. Otherwise, what's the point in victims coming forward? This sentencing is telling rapists it's okay to rape and telling victims that there's no point in coming forward.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Mara, you are remarkably brave, and we thank you for talking to us today. We are talking to Mara, who was in the courtroom when the sentence of no jail was handed down. She is a rape survivor. And we've been joined by her lawyer, Stephen M. Cohen, civil rights lawyer with Hogan Willig Law Firm. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, Jeremy Scahill of The Intercept on his new piece, The War Party, From Bush to Obama and Trump to Biden, U.S. Militarism is the Great Unifier. Stay with us. Quiet Before by From Monuments to Masses. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The United States is on pace to spend over $7 trillion over the next 10 years for the Pentagon. To put that number in perspective, the U.S. spends more each year on the military than China, Russia, India, the U.K., Germany, France, Japan, South Korea, and Australia combined. While Republicans and Democrats have sharp disagreements over the much smaller Build Back Better legislation, there's largely a bipartisan consensus when it comes to the military budget and foreign military intervention. We end today's show with investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill of The Intercept. His latest article is headlined The War Party. From Bush to Obama and Trump to Biden, U.S. militarism is the great unifier. Welcome to Democracy Now! Welcome back, Jeremy, former producer at Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out your thesis?
Well, you know, Amy, on the anniversary of 9/11, I was being asked to write pieces and to make media appearances because of the work that I had done throughout the war on terror that culminated with the film and book Dirty Wars, where I was investigating the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command and this expanding drone program and how the United States, under Barack Obama in particular, had moved toward an attempt, a radical attempt to normalize and legitimize assassination as a central component of American national security policy. And of course, you and Juan know well that the U.S. has long engaged in assassination and political assassination. But presidents have found a way around actually owning the fact that they were authorizing assassination. And under Obama, the term du jour was targeted killing. Now, under Joe Biden, we see them increasingly use the phrase over the horizon operations. And I hesitated to write anything on the 9/11 anniversary because I sort of came to the conclusion that we obsess far too much about the way in which 9/11 impacted the world. It is indisputable that the U.S. response to the 9/11 attacks altered geopolitical realities in the world and certainly altered the future of countries like Iraq and Afghanistan and the broader Middle East. But ultimately, I concluded that there's a sort of inherent intellectual dishonesty to pretending that the United States was not already on this trajectory prior to 9/11. And so what I'm trying to do in this piece is just establish some basic facts that we can use as a basis for discussing the U.S. role in the world. And that is that prior to 9/11, the U.S. was already on a course to do regime change in Iraq. In 1998, the bipartisan Iraq Liberation Act was passed that codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. It was largely the product of the work of the neoconservative Project for a New American Century. But even then, Congressman Bernie Sanders voted in favor of making regime change the law of the land in the United States. Bill Clinton had already moved toward small wars, as they say, and using remote lethal strikes, although they weren't really using weaponized drones under Clinton. They were being developed, but they didn't use them. They were using more legacy systems like cruise missiles to attack Afghanistan under Clinton, Iraq on an average of almost once every 3 days under Bill Clinton. And of course, the first attempt to kill or assassinate Osama bin Laden that we're aware of happened under Bill Clinton. So you had a foreign policy that was already moving toward a very radical embrace of this notion that the U.S. has the sovereign right to bomb any country anywhere, regardless of what the U.S. Congress had to say about it. And in fact, Joe Biden, as a senator in the late 1990s, was the chief congressional architect of Bill Clinton's 78-day bombing campaign of then Yugoslavia, which was done by Clinton over the explicit objection of the U.S. Congress. So you, on 9/11, you have these neocons come to power, the Bush-Cheney administration, with real veterans of Washington. They knew how to move the levers of power, and they also knew how to exploit the fear, the anger of the American people at the 9/11 attacks. And what we saw, Amy, was the Democratic Party just fall in line behind the Bush administration at every turn. And throughout the 8 years of Bush and Cheney, the Democrats would raise holy hell about certain war issues and the Iraq War. But when it actually mattered, when it was the Patriot Act, when it was the authorization for the use of military force, when it was the Iraq War, the kingpins and queenpins of the Democratic Party aided and abetted a militant neocon agenda. And we could talk a lot about Barack Obama, but in short, Barack Obama, when he campaigned in 2008 against Hillary Clinton in the primary and then against the notorious militarist John McCain in the general election, one of the main reasons why his campaign caught such fire was this notion that he represented something different than the bipartisan war party. And of course, what ended up happening when Obama comes into power is he lets the CIA off the hook. He lets Donald Rumsfeld and the other torture architects off the hook. And then he radically expands some of the worst aspects of the so-called war on terror and uses his credibility as a constitutional law scholar, as the first black president, as a sort of guy that was perceived as being a different kind of politician to push the U.S. Imperial agenda on a militarist level beyond what a John McCain would have done because he got the Democratic Party to support it.
And Jeremy, I wanted to ask you, are there any discernible differences that you can tell in the approaches to this imperial policy of the United States between the recent Democratic presidents? We're talking about obviously Clinton, Obama, and Biden, and the Republican ones, the two Bushes and Trump. Do you see any themes in terms of how they're various, they're Are there any different approaches from them in terms of imperial rule?
Yeah, Juan, I think let's start with like what I think is the most obvious issue that I think you could say it's a good thing that Joe Biden did this. And that is the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Certainly there are serious questions about the tactical withdrawal and the bloodshed that was witnessed in the scene at the Kabul airport. And Congress is going to, you know, spend endless time looking at those that span of a few days. In fact, I'll predict they're going to spend more time looking at Biden's withdrawal than they're going to spend looking at the catastrophic 20-year policy in Afghanistan. There was an enormous amount of pressure on Joe Biden to keep the war in Afghanistan going from within his own party, certainly from the military brass. And I think Biden deserves credit for standing up to them. I'm not sure that if Barack Obama had been the commander in chief during this period, he actually would have followed through as Biden did on a total withdrawal of conventional American forces. So I do think that someone who is this career politician specializing in foreign policy, I think Joe Biden knew the history well enough to know that he would have been taking a catastrophic gamble by keeping U.S. troops in Afghanistan. And I think that there are very outside of Bernie Sanders, I think there were almost no Democratic candidates that would have had the spine to follow through on Trump's withdrawal plan. Regarding China, I think, Juan, that it's a bit of a wash because you have both the Democrats and Republicans taking an increasingly hostile posture. And when you have someone like Trump engaging in the rhetoric that he engaged in, I think some world leaders can sort of recognize that this guy is a bit of a lunatic. But when you have Biden and his Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, staking out a very radical position on Taiwan, and then saber rattling and doing military exercises, it takes on a different level. So I think the Democrats have to engage in kind of theater about human rights and international law and due process. But they ultimately, at the end of the day, are just as aggressive as Republicans, albeit with some tweaking of the machinery.
And I wanted to ask you, given all of this emphasis now in the early days of the Biden administration on the threats from China, but even now in terms of the Soviet Union and Ukraine, of Russia and the Ukraine, the Soviet Union collapsed more than two decades ago. And China, despite its socialist veneer, has become the manufacturing linchpin of world capitalism. So isn't this renewed fear-mongering on the supposed threats from China and Russia simply a way to justify greater, as you say, government expenditures on the military complex, which then privatizes this stuff and for the consumer market? I'm thinking, for instance, of drones. Drones are now becoming a major consumer market when it started out as a military tool.
Oh, absolutely, Juan. And I think that if you look at the recent comments of Xi Jinping, particularly after his virtual summit with Joe Biden, he's been really hitting the talking point that what's happening is that the United States is taking this neo Cold War posture. And I think he's entirely right. But I sort of see it in the same vein as you, Juan. China, the United States and Russia in particular are engaged in a classic capitalist battle for control of natural resources all throughout the world. I mean, look what's happening on the African continent. You have China engaging in large-scale construction projects. You're also starting to see Chinese manufactured drones popping up in a variety of conflicts. You have the United States essentially agitating to bring down the Ethiopian government, albeit through sort of quieter diplomatic or back channels. But the United States and China and Russia are engaged in a very serious strategic battle over control of natural resources in a variety of regions around the world. And what I think is happening as a result of NATO expansion, of Biden being a tremendously hawkish figure on Ukraine and basically daring Vladimir Putin to stand up to NATO expansion, is that you run the risk of what is ultimately the business class, the elite business class of the world, having their battles spilling over into overt military conflict. And I think China in particular is very concerned about the aggressive U.S. stance, because I think China would be very happy to find a way to just sort of divvy up the world for domination in various regions. The United States is not going to accept that. And the U.S. posture is pushing China and Russia into an even closer alliance akin to the relationship during the Cold War.
We're talking to Jeremy Scahill, and I just want to note that Jeremy is sitting in front of perhaps the most famous anti-war painting ever, anti-war, anti-fascist painting, and that's Pablo Picasso's Guernica, the destruction of a Spanish town, city, Guernica, by the German and Italian fascist forces in support of the fascist Spanish general Franco. And although Pablo Picasso was Spanish, he lived in Paris and said his painting could never go back to Spain while Franco was still in power. But that's not what I want to ask you about, Jeremy. I wanted to ask you about that other piece you wrote, headlined, U.S. Absolves Drone Killers and Persecutes Whistleblowers. Can you talk about the last drone strike that we know of in Afghanistan during the U.S. withdrawal and what whistleblowers have to do with that?
Well, you know, Joe Biden made clear when he announced his withdrawal from Afghanistan that the United States was going to still have the capability to strike remotely. And, you know, it's a harrowing, grotesque flashback to many of the incidents we saw during the Obama era, where the Biden administration authorized a drone strike on what they claimed was a vehicle carrying ISIS operatives, and you had just recently had this terrorist attack at the Kabul airport during the withdrawal, and on the surveillance feed that the drone operators were looking at, we now know that they saw clearly at least one child, and still went forward with a strike, and seven of the 10 people killed in that strike were children, and 10 of the 10 people were civilians. Now, the person who's been convicted of leaking top secret documents and secret documents on the drone program, Daniel Hale, who is serving almost 4 years and is now in a Kafka-esque communications management unit in federal prison. One of the revelations that Daniel Hale was convicted of making that was published by The Intercept stated that at a certain period of time, U.S. so-called targeted killing operations in Afghanistan, as many as 9 of 10 people killed in the strikes were not the intended target. We don't know who they necessarily were. They could have entirely been innocent civilians, or they could have just been people the United States didn't know, but that the United States would preemptively categorize them as enemies killed in action. That was initially what happened in this strike as well, except 10 of 10 were civilians. And the one name that that everyone knows is the individual who worked for a U.S. aid organization was one of the people killed in this strike. So I and what happened after that is that the Pentagon did its own investigation of itself and exonerated itself of any crimes. This is the bipartisan self-exoneration machine that has long fueled U.S. military operations around the world. You know, Joe Biden was part of the Obama administration, of course.
We have 10 seconds, Jeremy.
As a global octopus with lethal tentacles that could strike anywhere, Daniel Hale should be freed. He is an American hero for revealing what we now see continuing under Joe Biden.
Well, Jeremy, we want to thank you so much for being with us, and we're going to link to your pieces, senior correspondent and editor-at-large at The Intercept. The latest piece, The War Party from Bush to Obama and Trump to Biden, U.S. Militarism, is the great unifier, as well as his piece, U.S. Absolves Drone Killers and Persecutes Whistleblowers. Tune in to Democracy Now! On Thursday when we mark our 25th anniversary with an hour-long special looking at show highlights over the past quarter of a century. And on Friday, we speak to Mansoura Daifi, who was imprisoned at Guantanamo for more than a decade. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.